This is Inside Wealth, the ultimate disclosure on Talk 910 KNEW. Living a healthy and happy life is about awakening the matters of your wallet, balanced by concerns of your heart. Now, Stu Zimmerman.
Happy Memorial Day, everybody, and welcome back to Inside Wealth, where once again, this is your oasis in the desert out there. If it seems like money is hard to come by, if it seems like feeling good and joyful and everything in your life feels hard to come by, this is the oasis. This is about your inside wealth, about a joy for living, because for all of the craziness out there, and we all know there's plenty of it, it is such a huge gift just to be alive. And yeah, we've been focusing on the money, don't you know? You've been spending a lot of your time focusing on money this week, have you not? And that is part of our lives' existence, that money does seem to be our lifeblood in many ways. How can we create money in ways that really bring out the best of who we are as human beings? So along that line today, we've got a great show. Right on point. We got Brent Kessel, CFP, Certified Financial Planner. Worth Magazine named Brent one of the top 250 financial advisors in the country. He's got a company called Abacus Wealth Partners. And he wrote a book called It's Not About the Money, Unlocking Your Money Type to Achieve Spiritual and Financial Abundance. Yeah, he's a brother of ours. We also have with us Hal Adler, president of a Great Place to Work Institute. You know, that's the group that puts out their findings in Fortune magazine every year, the 100 Great Places to Work. Well, he's joining us for our winning business segment, where he's going to give us a little more insight into what some of these great companies to work for are doing to truly create a winning business, because nobody has to lose. But before you get to Brent and Hal, you got this week's condensed, focused Memorial Day special bowl of stew. Let's focus on Memorial Day. And what does it have to do with wealth? Are you asking? I'll tell you. Because we all know that our financial wealth is really predominantly in the context of us living in this great country we call America, which is and has been the most financially prosperous country in the world for a while now, at least during our generation. And it has been, let's face it, if any of us were born in the middle of Africa, maybe South America, or even parts of Europe or Asia, wherever else in the world it could be, just maybe or highly likely, we would not have as much financial wherewithal as we have in this moment. So we can give it up for the United States a little bit, yay. And also for the men and women who served our country to defend it to the best of their ability in all these prior wars for a way of life, for a promise and a premise of a life of liberty, of freedom, of democracy, of dreams and opportunities being realized. That is what all these people gave their lives for. And for that, I think we can all say a profound thank you. Now, that said, there's a lot of question out there, especially in this election campaign that we're in, about what exactly is patriotic. And I'm wondering, I take a look at a guy, and you look at the business section, Carl Icahn, okay? The old corporate raider from the 80s. You know, he's resurfacing with Yahoo, taking a position in Yahoo and rattling their chain to kind of force them to be sold to Microsoft. Now, we all know and can expect that the fruit of that labor will result in many jobs at Yahoo being lost. So, for all of us who have money invested in Yahoo or who bought Yahoo with the arbitrageurs and everything else because, you know, we're looking to make things more efficient and it's the American way to capitalize on all financial opportunities, that is the American way. But I got a question for you. Is it patriotic? Is it patriotic, especially in this time of highly economic uncertainty, okay, where we have a credit crunch going on there. And I'm not sure if any of you applied for loans recently, whether it's a second on the house or anything else, even though our Paulson, the Secretary of Treasury, Bernanke, is telling us that they see that the credit crunch is abating. It's not true. When you actually apply for a loan, try it, you'll find out. It's not true. Loan requirements are tightening. Not to create panic, but that's the truth of it. But taking a look at Icon, for example, is just one example of what is considered the American way of maximizing profit at all or any cost. Is that patriotic? Is it patriotic in the context of we know that if he gets his way, he'll make some bucks and a lot of jobs will be lost? Is that patriotic to our country? Is that really what our country stands for? And I know we can go back to the American way, way back when. It really was founded on a premise of a nation, of what's in it for us, not what's in it for me. And we seem to be at a crossroads here because business as usual for quite some time has been what's in it for me. What's in it for me? The oil companies, what's in it for me? They haven't diversified, and rightly, you know, rightfully so in their own minds. What's in it for me, as opposed to what's in the best interest of our country? This is about Memorial Day, and I'm inviting you to remember the truth of who you are at the core, beyond all the labels. To live your life from that place, and remember that we are all in this together. And as Ben Franklin once said, we must hang together, or we will surely hang separately. Joining us in studio today is Brent Kessel, CFP. That's a certified financial planner. A Worth magazine named Brent one of the top 250 financial advisors in the country. And the company he co-founded, Abacus Wealth Partners, was named one of the top 250 as well wealth management firms by Wealth Manager magazine. So clearly, he's got one foot clearly on the financial ground, very clearly. He also wrote a great book called It's Not About the Money. Unlock Your Money Type to Achieve Spiritual and Financial Abundance. And with Ken Blanchard's commentary on the front cover and him having talked, Brent having talked with people like His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, to gather his information for this book, it's truly remarkable, and I highly recommend you read it. So first of all, Brent, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Stu. It's a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure as well. And so let's get right into your book and roll up the sleeves a little bit. The title, It's Not About the Money. That kind of defies conventional wisdom.
Yeah, it does.
Where it's about show me the money, and even if people aren't talking about it, they're kind of living their life with the golden calf ruling.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the reasons I named the book It's Not About the Money, Stu, was that in my working life, I have clients who have hundreds of millions of dollars of net worth, and I have other clients who have $100,000 of debt. And I found that regardless of the external circumstances, everybody struggles with money.
So why do you think that is? If we can go right to the core, because you know it seems to be conventional wisdom. Well, that's the way it is.
Yep.
We're just all focused on a material net worth, and it's a jonesing thing, right? We've got to feel better about ourselves by having a little bit more than the person down the block.
Right. You know, that's a great question. That's exactly the question I started to ask myself as I went from yoga mat to computer and from weekend retreat, meditation retreat, to financial planning conference, because I've spent 20 years doing intensive yoga and meditation practices and 20 years advising people about money. And, you know, what I noticed was that these Eastern traditions, these wisdom traditions, and by Eastern I also include Christianity and Judaism in that, they all study human suffering. They look for why is it that people struggle? Why is it that people can't break out of patterns that they're stuck in? And yet in the financial world, all of the answers to our struggles were external to us. It's invest this way. It's cut your spending so that you save more. It's get this insurance policy, not that one. It's tell your spouse to do X or not to do Y. It's all outside of the self. And you know, I really wanted to look at what is it inside us that's creating the suffering. And as one answer to your question, you know, why is it that the amount of money doesn't make a difference? The answer, it's kind of best told by John D. Rockefeller, who, when a reporter said to him, how much is enough? He answered, just a little bit more. And that speaks to this part of us that the Buddhists call the wanting mind that can really never have enough.
So How do we break out of that mold, given the fact that it does seem like our entire financial structure, let alone our own personal lives and how we define ourselves, are based upon that incremental acquisition?
Yeah. I think that the key, as with yoga, with meditation, is to look inward instead of outward. I'll just share, because it's a good moment to, when I asked the Dalai Lama, you know, why is it that Americans, rich and poor alike, struggle so much with money, and what can they do about it? His answer was, don't look outside yourself. That's nonsense. Look inward. And when we look inward, really study why we're behaving the way we are with money, we see this wanting mind that can never have enough. But more specifically, what we see is that when we get something we want, that wanting stops. For a short amount of time, we're not craving anything more. So you may have just bought the new pair of jeans. You may have just gone on the weekend escape. And you're kind of, it's a relief. It's a huge relief to not be fighting with life and trying to get it to be different than it is, which is what most wanting is.
Mm.
And so with that relief, there's a mistake that the mind makes. The mind says, oh, it's the pair of jeans or it's the weekend getaway. So next time I'm struggling, I want that again. But what you really want is the absence of wanting.
Or grasping, as the case may be.
Absolutely.
Yes. You know, it's really interesting. When we're talking about now Eastern versus Western philosophy here, where it looks like our economic system and our global capitalist system is based largely upon Western civilization,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to Eastern,
mm-hmm.
That a lot of our Western civilization is based on this notion called in the beginning, you know, God created man, mm-hmm. woman was a second fiddle,
mm-hmm.
you know, a spare rib, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And then next thing you know, she eats an apple that we're not supposed to eat,
mm-hmm.
and gives it to man. All of a sudden, we're covering up. We're running around naked, having a great time,
mm-hmm.
not grasping for anything, frankly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then all of a sudden, we realize that whatever we call God or the creator is up there.
Mm-hmm.
We're down here,
mm-hmm.
and we're ashamed of that. And the best we could possibly hope for is perhaps a little bit of power and a little bit of financial gain,
mm-hmm.
because that inner wealth that we're talking about here, when we really do have a sense of oneness and with the moment,
yeah,
which is kind of how you're describing that lack of wanting,
yeah.
and lack of grasping.
Yep,
it's not part of the Western mythology.
It hasn't been, but you know, the Western mythology isn't working out. I mean, most people, if they're really honest, and most people aren't honest, because it's very shameful, really, to admit your struggles with money in an open, public way. But if you're honest, people realize that this isn't working. I'm not happier now that I've gotten these things that I wanted or craved or grasped for than I was before I got them. I may have had some impermanent happiness or relief, but then my craving came back. So I need something different. And frankly, the answer is that God is here right now. I mean, all of that freedom, that paradise you just alluded to, is available right here, right now. And that's really what many of these more mystical wisdom traditions speak to and teach us how to do. There's over 50 exercises in the book that really help people, you know, bring that experience of freedom and transformation into their daily lives right here.
We're here with Brent Kessel, who, believe it or not, is a certified financial planner and a highly well-respected one. Not that I'm saying that you would doubt that, but it's just that clearly we are talking about a wealth that goes far beyond money.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, we can actually have abundance in all kinds. As opposed to just settling for that next material object, which, as you pointed out, has this diminishing returns kind of quality to it where it's never going to be enough.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, when we realize that the craving, the endless cycle hasn't worked, we become motivated to allow these grasping, craving impulses to arise and then fall away. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Zen Buddhist monk who Martin Luther King nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1967, I went and spent a week with him in France at his meditation center, and he said to me, freedom isn't a matter of the future. It's a matter of the present moment. And that's totally antithetical to everything we hear in the CFP world, in the financial press. It's all about where are you heading, you know, this golden age of retirement or the day when you get your portfolio up to X amount of dollars.
Right. I could be happy when,
yep.
or happy if,
yep.
as opposed to being here now with it.
One of the exercises in It's Not About the Money is if only. I have people write out, what's your if only? If only I had blank, then I'd be happy. If only this, then what? And when you get explicit about that stuff, see, That's the other mistake people make, is they sort of berate themselves for this. Like, I can't believe I act this way with money, or I can't believe I still want more, even though I've already got enough. And it's like pummeling a four-year-old child and expecting to change their behavior that way. Because this place inside us, whether it's the wanting mind or what I call our unconscious core story, these eight money types that I've defined in relationship to money, it operates at a very primitive level. It's very young. It was formed a long time ago. And you've got to engage it with compassion and invitation.
We're here with Brent Kessel. We're going to go deeper into what you can do to have the kind of wealth that money can't buy, and then have a new relationship with it so you can have it all, right here on Inside Wealth. We'll have more Inside Wealth right here on Talk Radio 910 AM, KNEW, San Francisco. You have a business, a mission, and a message. Inside Wealth can deliver that message to an intelligent, insightful, and mindful audience. Being a sponsor on Inside Wealth, you become an important player in a win-win agreement where nobody has to lose. Invest in your business and your purpose by calling 707-425-2360 or go to InsideWealth.net and sponsor radio that makes a difference. Inside Wealth, the greatest show on earth.
Imagine, you're lying in your bed stranded because you can't walk. Your friends and family go about their day, but you're left behind. You can't move without dragging your lifeless legs across the ground, stumbling every step, struggling to carry the entire weight of your body on two arms. This is reality for more than 100 million children and adults worldwide. They simply can't afford the one thing that will change everything, a wheelchair. We're the Wheelchair Foundation. We deliver hope, mobility, and freedom to impoverished people across the globe. And now you can be part of this great mission. A small gift from you can buy a brand new wheelchair and set a suffering person free. You won't believe how little it takes. Transform a life instantly. To make a donation or to find out how you can help, call the Wheelchair Foundation.
Call toll free 888-378-3839. 888-378-3839.
Are you looking to help give back to the community but need great flexibility? Tony La Russa's Animal Rescue Foundation, ARF, has a flexible volunteer position tailored just for you. You can share in the triumph of helping an orphan kitten or puppy, as well as receive unconditional love. ARF needs volunteer fosters to provide a little extra time or attention until these animals can be adopted into their forever homes. ARF will provide the food, medication, and support, and you provide the love. Check out ARF.net or call 925-256-1-ARF today. Please give puppies and kittens another chance.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
Introducing the greatest old-time radio shows of the 20th century, selected by Walter Cronkite. 20 hours of classic radio, including Orson Welles' legendary War of the Worlds, The Lone Ranger, and The Shadow. Plus comedy greats Jack Benny, Abbott and Costello.
I'm not asking you who's on first. I don't know.
And more. This digitally remastered cassette compilation comes complete with a 32-page commemorative booklet. Call now to order. You'll get 36 episodes for just $29.95 plus shipping and handling. That's 50% off the regular price. CD also available. As a bonus, you'll also get 2 episodes of The Bob Hope Show free. Old Time Radio is great family entertainment for listeners of all ages and makes a perfect gift. Order now.
Look, bud, I said your money or your life. I'm thinking it over.
For the greatest old time radio shows, call now. 800-622-3488. That's 800-622-3488.
Welcome to Inside Wealth. I'm your host, Stu Zimmerman, right here on Talk Radio 910 AM, KNEW. We're here in studio with Brent Kessel, a certified financial planner and a highly well-respected one at that. Ranked in the top 250 financial advisors in the country by Worth Magazine, and the company he co-founded, Abacus Wealth Partners, was also in the top 250 wealth management firms in the U.S. by Wealth Manager Magazine. And we're here talking about a book he recently wrote and came out with called It's Not About the Money: Unlock Your Money Type to Achieve Spiritual and Financial Abundance. So clearly we're talking about a tool of self-awareness here, so we have a better understanding of who we are in relationship to money, and hopefully beyond that. But you do mention there are archetypal patterns that we have, and there are 8 of them.
Yep.
That are like money personality types.
Yes.
Why don't you share with us what they are, so our listeners can start to understand more about who they are?
Sure, be happy to. So, I mean, I just want to say by way of background that I created these money types not just to have some cutesy labeling system, but because I was seeing that people really kind of fell into different groups around money. And more importantly, that they didn't, you know, that they didn't necessarily stay in those groups, that they could actually cultivate the other money personality types that were lacking, that were missing, and that were really causing most of their suffering and the reason they weren't having a balanced, happy relationship to money. So there's no hierarchy here. There's no better or worse. Each money type has good attributes and kind of, you know, lower functioning or more pain-inducing attributes, if you will. So I'll run through them kind of quickly, and then we can go into them in more detail if you want. The first is the guardian, who is always alert and careful with money. The second is the pleasure seeker, who seeks pleasure and enjoyment in the here and now. That's how they spend their money for the most part. The third is the idealist, who prioritizes creativity or compassion, sometimes social activism or spiritual growth over money. Fourth is the star. The star spends or lends or invests money to seek recognition, to feel hip or classy, or to increase their self-esteem. Fifth is the saver, and the saver accumulates financial assets to achieve security or abundance. Sixth is the innocent. The innocent really avoids putting significant attention on money and believes or hopes that life will work out for the best that way. Seventh is the caretaker. The caretaker gives and lends money away to express compassion and generosity. And eighth and finally is the empire builder, who thrives on the power and innovation required to create something of enduring value, usually a business.
Okay, so if all of them are, in fact, without any judgment, kind of equal,
yeah,
it sounds like each one of them has the capacity for struggle.
Yep, each one of them certainly has the capacity for struggle. And they struggle exactly to the extent that they are believed unconsciously, meaning if we just are following their dictate, their strategy for success, you know, without ever questioning it and without ever looking at whether it works, we struggle. So let's use the pleasure seeker for an example, because it's sort of obvious to everyone. At the lower functioning level, the pleasure seeker is the person who goes out and does retail therapy when they're feeling stressed about money. They buy things that make them happy. They bring sensory enjoyment. It might be great meals. It might be clothes. It might be trips. But it's all about feeling good. Doesn't really matter if people perceive them as being cool or hip for buying these things. Doesn't really concern them whether it benefits other people or not. It's really about their own enjoyment. So that's kind of the negative side. Now, if that's followed almost to the exclusion of all the other archetypes, energies, you know, if there's no saver in there to kind of accumulate for the future, if there's no guardian making sure they're not going to run out, these are the people who chronically overspend, who end up with a lot of consumer debt. But the same thing's true of the saver or the empire builder. The saver can just keep on accumulating. It's like the classic millionaire next door driving the 10-year-old used car, even though they've got $5 million saved up and invested. The empire builder who works 80-hour weeks, even though their business is already worth much more than they could ever spend in a lifetime. And it's because there's an intelligence to the strategy. The strategy has worked for them for so many years, they can't question it, really.
Well, it sounds like these are personality types that people would define themselves as and say that this is who I am, as opposed to this is just a pattern of behavior. I mean, can we really separate out who we really are from the way our personality deals with money?
That's a great question. I mean, my experience is that our personality is very separate from who we really are. I mean, if you're talking about that in the most kind of deep sense, you know, and I think anyone who's engaged in contemplative prayer or silent meditation or really kind of inquired into who am I, you know, what's at the root of all this, you realize, like the sage Lao Tzu did, that our conditioning creates our personality. It's just the experiences we've gone through that make me into Brent Kessel and you into Stu Zimmerman. And it's like what Lao Tzu saw was this leaf being blown by the wind through the sky. And it just suddenly clicked for him that if the wind were to change directions, the leaf goes a different way. And his life was no different. You know, the fact that I came from a family of divorce, the fact that I was born in South Africa and then moved to this country as a 10-year-old, the fact that I was in the mortgage business in my early 20s and had a huge deal fall through, and I was, you know, in debt on my credit cards and didn't know where next month's rent was going to come from. All of those experiences created the saver energy as being my dominant archetype. And then later experiences have balanced me out more. So, you know, by looking at that, and again, these exercises in the book, It's Not About the Money, really take you into what created your money type and how do you create some balance in it. And it is through balancing them out, through letting go of your sort of unconscious clinging to their strategies, that you start to realize who you really are, because you realize you're not just that personality type.
We're here with Brent Kessel, a certified financial planner and clearly a deep thinker in terms of taking a look at where true wealth really is. And can we actually have our feet in more than one of these personality types or archetypes simultaneously? Or is it a matter of kind of, depending upon which way the wind blows, do we shift from being, let's say, a saver to a guardian, or from a saver to a pleasure seeker to, you know, how does that work?
It's a great question. I mean, the answer is, left to our own devices, we'll tend to be in one much more dominantly than the others. The aim of the book and the aim of my work with clients and in workshops is that you have feet in more than one at the same time. So, you know, I've got this yoga background where I practice 2 hours a day, 6 days a week for about 16 years. And doing that with some pretty skilled teachers, they bring your attention to the part of the body that's most unconscious. So you might be doing a pose where you think the whole point is stretch your hand to the ceiling, and all of a sudden they're stepping on the outer edge of your back foot. You're thinking, well, I didn't even know that existed in this moment. But all of a sudden the whole pose wakes up, you know, and it's like you've brought awareness and consciousness to parts of the body that weren't even there before. So the idea, there's a chapter in the book called The Middle Way, and the idea behind that is that if you can cultivate putting feet in multiple personality types, multiple financial archetypes at the same time, you actually, that's how the transformation occurs. That's how you create the freedom and fulfillment we all say we long for. We think we're going to get there through our primary archetype. If I'm a saver, I think I'm going to get there by accumulating more and more and more and more money. And we never do, because it's so young and kind of just, you know, run by these early conditioned experiences. But as we, you know, cultivate the caretaker, which is more compassion and empathy, as I cultivated the pleasure seeker, which is really enjoying more of my money for today, as I cultivated the empire builder, which is really focusing on making a difference with my business, all of a sudden money became this much more rounded and fulfilling relationship in my life.
So that's really interesting, because here you're talking about having an inner transformation, if you will, through different action steps on the outside. So it's almost like transforming from the outside in.
Yep.
Rather than going from within and going into, let's say, meditation or yoga to help to wake up the parts of your being that you may be unaware of or unconscious, as you said in your term.
Yep.
And through that process, come to a deeper understanding of where you've been.
Yep.
and the context of, yeah, it's only been a set of experiences. It's
yep.
not who you are.
Yep.
And from that, have a greater sense of freedom to choose between other patterns of relationship.
Yeah. So the way I would say it is that the actions take place in the external world. The awareness, though, needs to be predominantly in the internal world. So yes, while you're going out there and giving more money away or investing differently or spending more of it on personal pleasure, the awareness where you're putting the attention is not on that. It's not on, you know, how are the investments doing, or, you know, what am I actually spending it on? The attention really is on, what's my reaction to this? What's my primary archetype doing as I do this? As I start to give some of my savings away, my saver is flipping out. He's not happy. You're threatening his very fundamental belief about what makes us secure and happy. And so one needs a lot of compassion, a lot of kind of, you know, really an internal spiritual practice is the way I describe it, to tolerate that. Otherwise, the saver is just going to come back up and say, no, you don't.
You know, right,
take
right.
back over.
Exactly. Now, I'm kind of curious, Brent, about, you know, the diversity of the people that you've interviewed.
Yeah.
In writing this book, and every person from the Dalai Lama to Thich Nhat Hanh and Ram Dass, to John Bogle, mm-hmm. who is the founder of the Vanguard Funds. Mm-hmm. So you talk to people both in the financial world and in the spiritual world.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find their observations to be significantly different in terms of relationship to money? Because clearly they have done different things with their lives.
Yeah. You know, it was more striking how similar they were. I expected there to be great, great differences. You know, I expected sort of the conventional wisdom, which is that the spiritual guys would say, yep, money's kind of dirty stuff. It creates a lot of suffering in this world. We'd be better off without it. You know, and I expected the financial guys to say, here's the smart things to do with money. And yeah, I don't really care about, you know, philanthropy. It's nice to do if you've got enough, but it's not anything integral. And it was the opposite. So the spiritual teachers, you know, Rabbi Harold Kushner, who, you know, is a wonderful teacher and author, you know, and the others, Joseph Goldstein, all saying that essentially money itself's not the problem. Being wealthy is not an impediment to spiritual growth. The impediment is craving and attachment. So it's that gripping kind of unconscious, you know, grasping, as you said, that is the impediment. The money itself's not the impediment. It's actually an aid. Thich Nhat Hanh said money's a great thing. It allows you to be able to go on retreats. It allows you to be able to use money to help other beings end their suffering. And those are all wonderful spiritual acts to do. And the financial guys surprised me too. I mean, it might be because many of them I spoke to, Dr. Harry Markowitz, Nobel Prize winner, John Bogle, they're in the later years of their careers, even though they're all still making great contributions. But, you know, they were all talking about philanthropy. Mike Murray, who was the former head of human resources at Microsoft, was another one. This man's dedicated his life to eradicating global poverty. You know, and so the financial guys were very inspiring in terms of saying that if you're not using your money for the greater good, for the interconnected well-being of all humans and, you know, and other beings, you're missing something, and you're doomed to a certain level of discontent, no matter how much you have.
Again, we're here at Brent Kessel, who's giving us some very sage advice here. He's a certified financial planner and also a yogi. So he's taken care of both his inner and outer abundance to the best of his ability and is certainly doing a great job from this humble vantage point. Let's talk a little bit about the spiritual abundance for a moment, because that is something that is and can be independent mm-hmm. of financial abundance.
Yeah, certainly.
So it's not required that you go and be the saver and make all the money so you can finally feel good about yourself and go out there and have a greater sense of compassion for humanity.
Yep.
That's a game we can play in this very moment.
Yeah, absolutely. The innocent often doesn't have much money. The pleasure seeker sometimes has money, but more often than not doesn't. And both of those archetypes can express generosity right now, today. It can be with money, it can be with time, it can be with, you know, skills and talents that they have that others don't. But it's really the sense. Yeah, so a lot of people have said to me, so what's so wrong with desire? You're talking about this wanting mind and craving and grasping. And yeah, I mean, I never would have gotten where I am in life without desire. And it's true. The distinction that I like to make is between the wanting mind's desires and what I call heartfelt goals. And the way to distinguish between them is wanting mind's desires are very self-concerned. They're just about me for the most part. You know, I want the chocolate milkshake now because I'm going to enjoy it. Heartfelt goals are, they almost always include benefit to other people and, you know, fairly direct benefit. So it's something I'm going to be doing that'll really help my family, someone I care about, you know, charity, someone who's suffering. And so there's a patience about them. There isn't this, you know, I've got to satisfy it immediately sort of component that there often is to the wanting mind's desires. And yes, every money type can start to express that regardless of money. I'll just say briefly, when I was in France with Thich Nhat Hanh and the 300 monks and nuns who live there, they have nothing. They get 40 euros a month of allowance. Most of them don't even spend half of it, and they give the rest to the Vietnamese orphans. And my experience was these were the happiest people I've ever met on the planet.
Well, there's a lot to be said for happiness. In fact, I think all of us would raise our hands that isn't that what a lot of the money's about? Isn't ultimately just boiling down to our happiness and the happiness of others? And with that, Brent, thank you so much for a great contribution to society with this book.
Thanks so much, Stu. It's been great to be with you.
Thanks for showing up. Welcome to the movement that takes your wealth to the next level. Beyond the surface of money to the service of money. where you get provocative commentary and lively conversation about inside wealth, right here on Talk 910 KNEW. Will, ownership, trust, appreciation, they all work in the financial world, and they are all keys to security and wealth beyond measure. And it's all in our book, Inner Security and Infinite Wealth, subtitled Merging Self-Worth and Net Worth. Hey there, it's me, Stu Zimmerman. Come to our website at insidewealth.net. That's insidewealth.net and order your copy today. That's insidewealth.net. We're blowing the doors wide open on Inside Wealth right here on Talk 910 AM, KNEW, San Francisco. And now it's time for winning business, because nobody has to lose. Not business as usual anymore. And with us today is Hal Adler, the president of a Great Place to Work Institute, where I'm sure you're familiar with their work. They publish 100 Great Places to Work every year in Fortune magazine. It's one of their feature magazines of the year. And it's amazing how the companies who typically wind up on their list have extraordinary profitability vis-a-vis their peers. So it's not just nice and fun. It's actually winning business. So Hal, thanks for coming back. And what do you have for us today?
Well, I think I'm going to expand a little bit on this idea of what's happening at Edward Jones relative to the investment community and relative to kind of harder financial times, and talk a little bit about Jim Weddle, the managing partner there, and his perspective on growth.
Yeah, please, because okay. There are tough times out there, and especially in the brokerage community.
That's right. That's right. There are definite challenges, and it's interesting to note that Edward Jones has a strategy for growth from to 2012 to grow from 10,000 branches or financial advisors, and their model is kind of, you know, one financial advisor per branch, so it's equivalent to the number of branches, to 17,000 by 2012. And I was on a plane on the way to our annual conference this year, where Jim Weddle, the managing partner, was going to had delivered a keynote. And I was thinking a little bit about Edward Jones, and we got to spend a little time with them the day before the conference while in St. Louis. And I happened to pick up the Harvard Business Review that month and was skimming through it, relaxing on the plane, and there was this really terrific article by David Collins about strategy. And the article itself had asked the question, can you say what your strategy is? And it was a little piece on how important it is to be succinct and to drive the strategic thinking and methodology through the organization so everyone gets it, everyone understands. Just so happens, this became a little bit of an Edward Jones case study. So the timing was just excellent. So I read, and I'll quote from the article, Edward Jones aims to grow from 17,000 financial advisors by 2012 from about 10,000 by offering trusted and convenient face-to-face financial advice to conservative individual investors who delegate their financial decisions through a national network of one financial advisor offices. Now, I read that quote specifically because this is their growth strategy, and this is specifically very well chosen word-for-word terminology that is shared across the organization. The article goes on to say that most people in that company, if stopped in the hall, would be able to recite that. I tested my theory a little bit and brought that, or I tested their theory a little bit and brought that into Edward Jones when I went, and sure enough, the people that I spoke with were very, very clear about what that strategy was, what made it distinctive, and how it was going to get done. So in my first conversation with Jim, the question that I wanted to understand was, how do you nearly double an organization that's values-driven and has some very clear core values while keeping that value system? And that's one of the challenges that these great companies and companies on the journey consider as top of mind, which is, how do we grow in a way that scales the culture? How do you grow? How do you get big and stay small? In the case of Edward Jones, it's how do you get bigger still but maintain that set of values? And Jim was extremely clear that it really was and always will be about the values. And he said, if we live those values, if the 10,000 we have now live those values to the extent that we hold them accountable, to the extent that we hold ourselves accountable to, then we're going to get to 17, 27, or 37,000 without a problem. And he went on to recite the values very, very clearly, one by one. He said, number one, our clients' interests come first. An And they talked about that, how in a great company, it doesn't always have to be employees first. We hear a lot about the number one companies, the number five companies, putting employees or any company on that list, or great companies, putting employees first. Edward Jones puts the needs of the client first and is very, very clear about that. And it helps them to drive and to operate their business in a way that people in there understand. He talked about we value working in partnership as a core value, that individuals and their contributions are valued and respected, and that they believe in quality-oriented, long-term investment philosophy. And all sorts of thinking fell out of those values, and we talked about them. But the point was that I'm clear, said Jim, the organization is clear, and it doesn't matter how big we get, those values are going to keep us true to who we are.
Well, that's perfect, because that way, you're right. It's easy when you're in a high growth mode to have that next incremental person coming in dilute the culture a little bit.
That's right. And, you know, the bigger a company gets, the bigger an organization gets, the harder it is for an organization to stay true to that, because of course you've got that dilution, as you say. You've got a bigger scope to manage, you've got more people to help understand and to help resonate. And it's all in the actions of the company. So I said, you know, I asked in the last growth spurt, you know, coming out of the whole .com thing and the internet trading, you know, I imagine that your philosophies were challenged, that your values were challenged, because you have a model, or they do at Edward Jones, that isn't, you know, quick win. It's not a quick win kind of do-it-yourself model. And he spoke to that specific conversation that they had across those years as one of the most important turning points, that everyone in the market was beginning to cater to the self-service, do-it-yourself investor, the guy that was trying to make $1 million overnight. And they held true because their core value, that fourth one that I read, we believe in quality-oriented, long-term investment philosophy. And regardless of how much pressure they're getting, even from their internal people, they held true. And you fast forward 5 years later, they're the only ones that didn't take that wild ride. But they've had clear and steady growth right through that period. And this is how actions match words, which is, I can't say enough, how distinct a quality of a best company that is.
Well, Hal, thank you so much, because what it really comes down to, everybody, is identifying, having absolute certainty what your values are and adhering to them.
Exactly right.
As your primary engine.
Exactly right.
Hal, thank you again so much, as always, for your wisdom.
Stu, always a pleasure. Please feel free to reach out anytime.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, so the magic word for today is putting values into action. That's not a word. That's about four of them. It's a phrase. But it really is about putting values into action, because we can all talk a big game about values, but sometimes they're a little bit harder to actually put into practice. And with that as a backdrop, I'm really inviting you all to come to InsideWealth.net. That's InsideWealth.net, because we actually have some partners of ours, our referral network, who put their values into practice. A value of a dedication to excellence of service, for communication, for really serving. And we're talking about people like Hutch Ashew over at Pillar Financial, or John Menke at Menke & Associates with employee stock ownership plans for your company, so that your employees can own a slice of the pie, dare I say, to expand it even bigger. You know, J.P. Morgan once said, I'd rather have 1% of $1 million than 100% of $10, or something like that. You get the drill. Come to InsideWealth.net, where, just like Hal Adler is talking about, these people are putting their values, and frankly, they're putting your values into practice. So what better way to do business than to really have it all lined up? Because I think we're all a little bit sick and tired on some profound level of people checking values at the door, not being honest, not being open, with fees, with service, with deal creep, with, you know, you name it. All the ways in which people say one thing and do another in business. And we all know that a lot of it, and I think we can all fess up to having experiences this for ourselves as human beings, that when money gets involved, frequently it's easy to go to a place of fear. And it's easy to go to a place of scarcity. And that maybe it's not enough. or I need to make this financial conquest, or whatever the thoughts that go into it. And we all know that this happens. We're not always honest. We're not always honest in business dealings, no matter how other ethically, moral, responsible, religious, however we like to define ourselves as good human beings. Behind closed doors, without having a priest or anybody else on the other side for confessional, I think we all know that on a profound level, that abundance thing, it's a challenge for many of us, which is the purpose of why we have this whole show in the first place, is how can we put our values into practice? How can we live a life of abundance that includes the financial and, frankly, blows it away? Because we do know that some of the greatest moments in our lives, you know, whether it's a birth of a child or that amazing run down a ski slope, or maybe it's a ski jump, or maybe it's going off to a foreign country, or whatever these experiences are, a first kiss, whatever it happens to be, money can't buy that. Money cannot buy that. And yeah, we all seem to be, you know, as we talked about in the bowl of stew, you know, where we're wrapped up in this whole kind of, give and take thing with respect to our country, where on this Memorial Day weekend, where on one level, you know, nobody else is living our lives, and so it's so easy for us to go to a place of survivor mode and what's in it for me, and always look to kind of, you know, in all of our transactions and relationships and everything, to kind of have an upper hand or to be in control, or to make sure, you know, somehow it feels so often in life, that things are zero sum, where either you win or you lose, and if you wind up with less, somebody else is getting more. And then it becomes, not just Edward Jones, but keeping up with the Joneses, and all of that. And it can be really troubling. And especially as we take a look at our country, where you know we're at a crossroads, people, don't you? I mean, we do know that. We certainly seem to be going to this, rapidly approaching this election time, which is going to determine not only the future of our country, the future of our world, not to be overly dramatic about it, but that is, in fact, what is at stake. We know that. And we know that we have these archetypes out there. We have John McCain, who represents some form of security, I guess, on some level. Certainly, he represents militarism as the best defense being a good offense. He certainly represents, in many ways, a status quo. So and for many of us, there's a comfort in the devil that you know. Even as the approval ratings of the current devil, let's call him the president, frankly, are not that high. So even people who identify themselves traditionally as Republicans and who may have voted for him more than once are dissatisfied with the level of integrity and the level of how the values, going back to what Hal was talking about with the winning business segment, going back to how the values are actually put into practice, because they wrap themselves around the flag and as being patriotic. And being patriotic means having a good, strong military and fighting our battles over there so they don't have to fight them over here. And defending our oil interests, because we all know that even beyond our borders, it really comes down to money. And, you know, that's one archetype. We certainly have Hillary Clinton, who, you know, certainly represents on one level something new. She's a woman, in case we haven't noticed, which is sometimes hard to notice because she certainly brings some cojones to the party here. So she's doing her best to play the role of the woman in the man's world, needing to be tough, needing to, you know, I got your back, America, which implies that we are going to be fought here, and we need to have protection from behind because people want to attack us from behind. And I will fight for you because that also appeals to this older world view of us against them. And it still shines true in our economics, even as we have all these companies out there who are doing what's in their own personal interest in many cases in terms of the bonus and the stock options and everything else that goes into their wallet rather than what's in the best interest of our country. So I don't know. Do you think it's in our best interest of our country to be so addicted to drugs? And that's a good thing so long as they're pharmaceutically prescribed so they can make profit on it. If it grows out of the ground, then all of a sudden that has to be regulated. So, you know, without making any other comments on that as to whether they're right or wrong about marijuana or any other kind of pharmaceutical that is its natural nature, it can't quite be regulated. It's not really quite the issue. The issue really is what is in the best interest of our country. And as we think about Memorial Day, why not remember what the premise of this country really is, of life, liberty, they say pursuit of happiness. I would say let's make it presence of happiness so that the pursuit doesn't always have to be out there. Because for many of us, the pursuit of happiness is really the pursuit of coin. And that is what we've determined our happiness to ultimately be. And we all know on a deep, profound level, there's more than that. And that's what I'm inviting in for this Memorial Day. Is to, in the immortal words of Mufasa in The Lion King, Simba, remember who you are. I'm inviting you to remember who you are. Beyond time and space, beyond this body, and beyond all of the labels and the roles that you identified yourself to be. Because on a profound level, you know, you are so much more than that. Until next week, invest in yourself, your passions, your purpose, and your planet.
Join us again same time next week on Talk 910 KNEW. And be sure to visit our website at InsideWealth.net. Subscribe to our podcast, blog, or learn more about Inside Wealth with Stu Zimmerman. Thanks for listening. Talk 910 KNEW.
You have a business, a mission, and a message. Inside Wealth can deliver that message to an intelligent, insightful, and mindful audience. Being a sponsor on Inside Wealth, you become an important player in a win-win agreement where nobody has to lose. Invest in your business and your purpose by calling 707-425-2360 or go to InsideWealth.net. Inside Wealth, the greatest show on worth.